Born in Dublin, Ireland, Nuala O'Connor is a fiction writer and poet. She's published 2 novels, 4 collections of short fiction, and 3 poetry collections. She holds a BA from Trinity College and a master's in translation studies from Dublin City University. Nuala has worked as an arts administrator in theater. She's been a translator, a librarian, and she's currently a teacher of creative writing there in Galway, where she lives with her husband and 3 children. Nuala O'Connor, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much.
And we're talking to you all the way from Galway, Ireland. Now, in Ireland, you're a pretty well-known writer, and but you're known there as Nuala. Can you help me say that?
Yeah. It's Irish Gaelic. It's Ní Cruachóir. So the way you spell it and the way you say it is completely different.
Right.
My American publishers, Penguin, asked if I would consider anglicizing my name to make it simpler for an American audience, so I agreed. It's absolutely fine.
And is this your first book published in the United States?
Yeah, my first novel. I had a chapbook of flash fiction out with a very small press, but this is my first, proper publication, let's say.
It's a fantastic book, and it's getting a lot of attention, a lot of good reviews. Maybe we can just start by you telling us how this book came about.
Well, I suppose like every American teenager, we studied Emily's poetry here in Ireland for school. And she just has remained a companion poet to me since then. So I've been reading her, I suppose, upwards of 30 years. And I heard then a couple of years ago that Emily loved to bake, and I love to bake. So I looked up her recipes and I began to bake her things like coconut cake and gingerbread and black cake. And I wrote a poem, and then around that I was thinking about the fact that they may have had Irish domestics, because so many Irish women who emigrated ended up as domestic servants. And then I discovered she had had several Irish servants, but for the purposes of the novel, I invented a new one, a cousin of Maggie Marr, who was one of her most well-known servants, long-standing. She was with the family for about 30 years. But just for myself, for the sake of invention and for the freedom that it offers, I invented a 17-year-old maid. So she comes to the Dickinson home and conducts this cross-generational friendship with Emily.
And you're, of course, referring to Ada. And the book really is a relationship between Emily Dickinson and this maid, Ada. And it goes back and forth, a chapter told through the perspective of Emily and a chapter told in the perspective of Ada. And I can see how baking was one of the very first things that unified them. And can you tell us about, as you were writing this, did you evoke the whole experience of baking? Did you make cakes, for example, as you were writing, and did the smell influence you? Or how did that come into the creative process itself?
Yeah, I bake anyway. I keep a bakery blog. So I was making Emily's recipes, and a couple of them have stuck. I still make her coconut cake all the time. We had the launch of Miss Emily in Dublin last week, and I made coconut cake, and my cousin made gingerbread based on Emily's recipes. It's the whole, rather than shying away from the domestic in literature, I was embracing it quite deliberately. As we know, Emily, from her late 20s on, pretty much sequestered herself in her home. And so Ada comes to that, but she's an active young character, so she gets to go outside the Dickinson home and we get to go with her. So as you said, it's a dual narrative. So we're very much, when we're with Emily and Ada, we're very much in the domestic space, either of the Dickinson kitchen or in Emily's bedroom where she wrote a lot. Or indeed up in the cupola on top of the house where she also liked to go to spy on the town, as it were. So, yeah, I did find and still find that baking one of Emily's recipes connects me to her. She's one of those people, one of those poets who, when she gets a hold of you, she really doesn't let go. So I find, even though I wrote the novel, finished writing the novel 2 years ago, and then it was sold to Penguin in January last year and has just come out, I'm still buying books about Emily Dickinson. I'm still researching her.
Right.
I'm still discovering things about her. I'm still sort of, not obsessed is a terrible word, but I'm still very, intrigued by her and connected to her. So there is a thing whereby when you start to love her. It's not a love that ends, you know?
Right. You know, one of the things that strikes me as you're speaking, but also just in sort of the research, you know, behind all this is writers often feel a kind of, you know, literary or even spiritual kinship sometimes with other writers who, you know, have come before them. And it sounds, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but it sounds kind of like that's what you're, you know, you're talking about, is this kind of almost being able to sort of identify or relate with her work in some way. I'm just curious, you know, what is it, if you can just talk a little bit more about that, what is it about her work that drew you to her, or that continues to sort of pull you back into her work, to her life also?
Well, I love her idiosyncrasy, you know, with grammar and with, I actually love the shape of her poems. A lot of her poems have this kind of rectangular shape, very neat. She uses these hymnal beats, and so the poems tend to have a similar sort of a beat to them. And as a poet myself, I tend to write short lyrics, and they tend to have short lines. I'm kind of, I can be kind of rigid in how I want a poem to look, you know?
Sure.
I don't like the hanging line or anything like
right,
that.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. But so I was drawn to that, but also, of course, her treatise on mental health, you know,
right.
And
yes.
The way she wrote about fame, the way she wrote about death. I don't know, I just find, and the way she's very aphoristic as well. There's a lot of wisdom in the poem.
Yes.
I mean, the ones we studied in school were really the ones about the breakdown of the mind and about death. We didn't study Wild Nights, or, you know, right. Any of the kind of more ones that were based on nature or anything, which, of course, she has, you know, hundreds of. She was
sure.
As crazy about gardening as she was about writing. So, you know, we really have a lot of nature poems from Emily. I'm attracted to her concision and her brevity, because there are things I value. Like, I've written 3 novels and a lot of short story mm-hmm. collections. I write a lot of short fiction as well as flash fiction. So brevity kind of is my thing. I like writers who keep poetry in the language, but who do it in a concise way.
Right.
You
that
know?
Even comes so, through in your book here. There is a sort of the brevity in the chapters, you know, in the sort of pacing as well that's in there. That's obvious throughout the book.
Yeah, as a reader, I have to say, well, as a reader, I like a lot of things, but I do love short chapters. And
right.
So,
yeah,
as
so
a writer,
do I. yeah, right.
And as a writer, I kind of gift them to the reader. Here
yeah,
you go,
yeah,
here's a
gift,
tiny
yeah.
chapter.
Right.
That's all you have to read tonight, you know?
That's right.
She has a lot to offer. I think maybe what we learned at school was a bit on the dark side for some people. I like the dark side, so that's not a problem.
So do we here.
But I
so.
Think if people go and read, you know, some of the 1,800 poems, we probably learned up to 20 maybe, you know, you'll see that there is actually a very light side to Emily and a very playful and fun side. And I hope that my novel shows that she was fond of riddles. She was fond of laughter. She had she was very warm. I mean, it's on the record that she was always very friendly with the domestic servants in her house.
Mm.
So that's not an invention on my part. She
right.
really was. Even the kids who came to visit the house always said, oh, Emily would always give you a piece of cake, but Vinnie, her sister, wouldn't necessarily give you a piece
yeah.
of cake. So she had a warmth that maybe a lot of people are not aware of.
Yeah, no, that's definitely reflected in her character. You know, I was reading this article in the Washington Post about this novel. One of the things it says is that a surprising aspect of this novel is that the voice of the Irish maid is more engaging than that of the famous poet. And the fact is Ada, the maid's chapters are incredibly compelling, and, you know, even on the level of a poetic sensibility. And even at the end of the novel, we have this quote, the maid says something that we find in Emily Dickinson's poetry itself. I
yes.
won't say what that is. I'll let the reader find that himself, but it's certainly one of the most famous quotes or images that we relate to her poetry. You seem to be just as in love as a writer with Ada as you are with Emily Dickinson. Did this come about eventually, gradually, or did you know who this character was?
I think originally I had this idea to write about a different Ada, one who was a theater player. She was an actress.
Mm.
And this was my original thought about a theater player who went to America. And then when the whole Emily Dickinson baking, etc. thing happened, you know, in my reading, everything changed. And I think this happens often when I write. I start with one notion of what I'm doing and end up somewhere completely different. But when I was writing their voices, in a sense, I had to tone Emily down, because when you read her letters, she was very loquacious. And as I said, she loved riddles. So her letters can be quite cryptic. I'm sure sometimes the people she was writing to were, you know, sitting there kind of questioning, what is she trying to say, you know? And then on the flip side, when I read Maggie Marr's letters, the real servant, she probably wasn't very educated. So the letters were quite stiff and almost dull. Mm. And so in a sense, I had to tone Ada up to match Emily. Mm, so right. I spent a lot of time on the two voices, trying to make them as vibrant as each other, but right. very unique to the person that they were as well. So I tried for Ada to use, I kind of made it easy on myself. I made her be from my home place in County Dublin, mm. where my parents, who are, my father's in his 80s now, so they were born and bred there. So it's not a huge leap to go back, you know, another 80 years or so into the last century. So I very much mined my parents' language for the language, and I tried to test every phrase for veracity so that it wouldn't be out of place for the time. So I took a lot of care with the voices, and it was important to me that Ada not, she was one of those, she was a positive immigrant, shall we say. She mm-hmm. wasn't forced out of Ireland. She went willingly. She came with a big open heart and open eyes and, you know, was kind of dying to learn about America and dying to fit in. So the two meet. While Emily is withdrawing from the world, Ada, in a sense, is just entering it. And so there's this lovely, I hope it's lovely, learning process between them. All the conversations that take place in the Dickinson kitchen are about them learning from each other as much as baking together and cooking together.
You write that you need to be haunted by your characters in order to write them. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering mm-hmm. about, there's this very difficult moment in Ada's life where she is attacked. And it's something you don't hide. Right at the beginning, we know something bad is going to happen with this kind of shady character. Was that a difficult scene for you to write?
It was difficult, and in a sense, I avoided it. I wrote it as a very, very short chapter where you yes. get a lot of impressions, but it's not spelled out. And it's not until later when she's haunted by this terrible thing that's happened, Ada is haunted by it, that you get sort of flashbacks to it. And then you really understand, you know, the severity and the depth. And I suppose the novel asks the question, can people really get over terrible events, or does it change your life forever? So, yeah, I mean, that sort of thing is very difficult to write. And I know a lot of book bloggers are sent the book by publishers, and they review it, and a lot of them, they tend to excel in spoilers, but a lot of them... They really objected to this, you know, yeah. and they got quite strident about it. And, you know, the thing about literary fiction is it is not easy. It's generally about mavericks who get up to things that are not necessarily going to make them happy, you know. So I think while it's a story of friendship, you know, it's also a literary novel, and things are going to go wrong, and then your characters are going to hopefully drag themselves out of the morass in some way.
You know, and also it really brings in context the times that this novel is set in. I mean, if we think it's bad for women and, you know, victims of sexual assault today, I mean, what was it like back then? And it mm-hmm. really kind of shows how, you know, immediately the blame, you know, might go to the victim. And then the other thing is the detail that really struck me. I think you handled it very well, by the way. The first chapter that where the actual happened, you know, that jump in time was just brilliant. And then, you know, how you come back a little Truman Capote-like with the little images here and little images there, I thought was wonderful. But one of the images that struck me is the attacker smells like almonds. And I couldn't help but think of Garcia Marquez, you know, the smell of unrequited loves is almonds, you know, and this guy really was trying to give her attention. Beautiful. And but it's just such a fantastic detail and handled very well.
Yeah, I probably had it in a little bit more and was told to tone it down a bit. There was just too much of it. And it was a bit, the sort of link between poison and almonds was maybe a bit too obvious. So, you know, I got great comments from my editors about where to sort of, you know, leave things in a sense, and where to kind of heighten them, you know. I found the editing process with Penguin was excellent, actually. They were very good.
Great.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Nuala O'Connor, author of Miss Emily, a novel that's based on the life of poet Emily Dickinson. Nuala, you know what? Something that actually I was thinking about was, do you consider this novel a historical novel, like historical fiction, or would you just call it fiction, straight fiction? Or was there any sort of issue around the idea of genre, what genre this fell under?
Yeah, I would call it historical fiction. I have no problem with those kind of genre labels. Mm-hmm. An academic friend of mine, who's actually an Emily Dickinson scholar, said to me he would consider it neo-historical fiction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when I asked him what did he mean by that, he said, you know, that it's historical fiction written with 21st century sensibilities, that Emily Dickinson is very obviously a sort of a proto-feminist in the book, you know?
Right.
But then she takes a path maybe that a well-to-do woman of her era, it was unusual for her to take, not to marry, not to have children, to stay in her father's home, etc.
Sure.
But in another sense, Emily could afford to do that because her family were wealthy. Now, her family had lost their money. Her grandfather had lost their money, but her father built up the wealth again and then became, I don't know why, if he just worried over their health constantly, but he became quite protective of his children. So when Austin married, he said, oh, I'm going to move to the Midwest. And father said, oh, I'll build you a house here on the land. Why don't you stay?
Right.
So he did. And then, as we know, neither Emily nor her sister Vinnie married. They stayed in the parents' house. The parents died in the house, and Vinnie and Emily went on living there. So she's, because of her status in life, and the novel is about social standings and social orders, she was able to do that. Whereas someone in Ada's position, for example, had to work because that was just that was where she was coming from. And I was trying to talk a bit about as well immigration and attitudes towards the Irish who were on the lowest rung at that point. And I made Austin Dickinson the baddie. There was some anti-Irish sentiment in the Dickinson family, for sure. It softened over time, especially as a lot of their domestics were Irish and they got to know them. But early on, there are letters between Emily and Austin where they really have a go at the Irish, you know.
Hmm. Did you have any concerns about fictionalizing Emily? I mean, were there any sort of obstacles maybe just for yourself in terms of, you know?
She's an American icon. What in God's name was I doing? I tiptoed towards it. I tiptoed back. Eventually, I embraced the thing and got going. And then, like, once you've kind of been doing the research and the writing and you've gotten to know everybody and you've, you know, you've read whatever 30 books around the subject, you gain a sort of a sense of ownership, you know, real or imagined.
Sure.
You start to feel like you know these people extremely well and that you can be authoritative. I also approached Emily with a lot of love and respect. I didn't want to have her do anything that would be completely outside of her character or that wouldn't sit well with the facts of her life. So I think I approached her in a respectful way, and that respect remained and grew throughout the process of researching and writing the novel. I really have to say, I just love her. I love her work. I love her audacity in being the woman she was at the time she was. You know, it must have been, you know, really unusual for a Victorian woman to stop going to church, for example.
Mm-hmm.
She really knew herself. She knew her own mind, and I admire that.
There's clearly a connection and affinity with Emily Dickinson and her poetry, and even the advice that she gives on writing. It sounds really kind of like it just reads like a labor of love. But I'm wondering if there's also a connection with Dostoevsky. And the reason why I ask, of course, is because Sue is telling her, you really need to read Crime and Punishment. And then later on, we have a scene where Daniel and Ada are at a circus, and there's this, they witness this beating of a lion, this kind of merciless beating of a lion. And, of course, that evokes Raskolnikov's dream. And I'm wondering if you consciously made thematic and or some sort of connection with Dostoevsky as you were writing this novel.
No, I absolutely didn't. I had Daniel and the Lion in mind,
yes.
which was more biblical, I suppose. Emily read the Bible hugely, and she was very connected to it, even though she wasn't saved, inverted commas, as many of her contemporaries were, you know. she never stood up for God in a sense. And even the fact that she stopped going to church was proof of that. So while she knew the Bible inside out, she wasn't necessarily keen on practicing her religion, though I think her poems were probably her prayers, if anything. But no, it was Daniel and the Lion I had in mind. The reference to Crime and Punishment was, you know, when you look at the Dickinson Library, they were great purchasers of contemporary work and of classics. Like, Emily read Dickens and she read George Eliot and the Brontes. She really devoured books the way probably every writer devoured books. So she loved what we would call throwaway contemporary novels now, you know. She loved light stuff as well. She was as capable of getting excited about something very, I don't want to use the word trashy, it's a horrible word.
Popular.
You know, of a kind of a light novel of her era, as she was to wax lyrical about Dickens. So there was great, her father used to buy her books, but he would hand her the books and say, don't read them, you know, because he feared they would joggle her mind, as he said. So, but she did, she had pretty good education, thanks. They did believe in women's education in Amherst and Massachusetts hugely, and still do, obviously. But, you know, when she was allowed to school, when her health wasn't being safeguarded hugely, she got to go, and she studied botany and all sorts, Latin. You know, she was quite well-educated in up to a point, if you know what I mean. But she got her education from books.
Is a fantastic novel, Miss Emily by Nuala O'Connor. And thank you, Nuala, for appearing on Words on a Wire. We wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much. Thanks a million. It was lovely to talk to you.